Welcome to Security.com, the podcast, where we're bringing together in-depth intel, real talk, and the human side of cybersecurity. I'm your host, Dan Mellinger, and each episode I'll be joined by industry experts, defenders, and voices from the front lines to explore the latest enterprise security insights straight from the pages of Security.com and the mind shaping the field. Today we have a very special guest, a longtime friend, former colleague, super smart guy. When I talk about experts and defenders, he's definitely one of both of those things. And he's kind of legendary in the cybersecurity vulnerability researcher space as well. So, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great, great opportunity to be on this page. And I love the podcast. And I'm super psyched you got the security.com name. That's amazing.
Dude, yeah, that was, you can thank CA Technologies for that. They actually got the license long time ago and held the domain somehow till now. So lucky there, and we'll keep using it. But yeah, thanks so much. So just by way of introduction, by the way, so Jerry primarily today is talking about his personal innovation lab called Rogo Lab. So he founded this thing. Jerry is kind of the an architect, I guess you could say, of some of the best open source tools for tracking and understanding the effectiveness and efficacy of vulnerability management. So some of the websites and tools you can find online are cve.icu, patchthis.app, cvsforecast.org, and most recently, a CNA scorecard. So just to kick things off, Jerry, could you give the audience a primer on kind of what is vulnerability management? Like, what are these CVEs? What's MITRE? How does that all work?
So vulnerability management is going through kind of a rebranding, you would say. When I started 20 years ago, 25 years ago in the industry with government, vulnerability management was coming in on a Saturday night and patching Windows servers in the data center. You had to do it by hand. You couldn't do it automatically. Things might break. You move 10 years later and Linux has got a foothold in the organization. And so now you're looking at two or three different patching cycles and patching information. And so you're taking in all of that. And then you get to where we are now, and Microsoft and Linux have pretty well mastered the auto patching. So we're not spending a lot of time thinking about our OS patches as much as we're spending time thinking about software that we've custom wrote and support internally, or our website, or the software that runs our business that everybody's afraid to touch. You have versions of Java that are super old. You have people who use versions of Acrobat that are super old because business context is built around that, and they have to have that version. And you think, oh, just go update it. But there's no way to do the testing and having the time you need to do the testing to make that work. So vulnerability management in 2025 moving forward is about finding those pain points and really focusing your time on there while we allow automation to take over some of the load that people spent most of their time on 10 years ago.
Interesting. Yeah, and vulnerability, right? It's some kind of a software issue that someone else can unintentionally utilize to, you know, get in your systems.
Yep.
And used to be the primary way folks got into systems, especially in the old, like you said, old days of the Microsoft pre-patch Tuesday, and even now with some of the automated stuff. But it's interesting how it's shifted to trying to find and identify vulnerabilities in kind of the less used software, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Yeah. Not less used, I would say. It's really a dichotomy because it's the most important software in companies. So it's the least likely to be touched unless there's an absolute need, right? Like, you have a company, a bank, and they're running on Java. You don't get to update Java every time a new patch comes out. You have to go through an approval process. There's normally checkoffs by CISOs. There's a lot of testing you have to do. So it gets to the point where getting these updates in are hard. So just anybody in the vulnerability management space needs to know what they're running and how they're vulnerable, because you can't just go in every day and say, oh, there's a new Java vulnerability. I have to take down all of the check processing for this bank to patch it, right? You have to be really, really clear and understand what your vulnerability actually is, if this patch fixes it, and what other damage it could do to our company.
Interesting. So kind of maintaining almost like an audit of the software you're running, how important it is, when it's worth it to take down. And then I think a lot of this stuff is kind of the prioritization side too. Like, is this worth downtime, yeah. Right?
Yeah. And do you know what's out there, and can you take the downtime? Earlier last year and into the early this year, you noticed VPN concentrators were showing up in the news about being exploited frequently in turnover. And I'm 90% sure that's the same case, right? Your company, you have remote employees, you have this VPN appliance that people have to use to get their work done. You have employees all over the globe, or at least spread across, you know, 5 or 6 time zones. Try to pick a time when you can take down this VPN concentrator to patch it that won't make anybody miss work or whatever, because as soon as you take it down, somebody is going to call somebody's boss. He's going to call your boss and ask, you know, why didn't you know that Friday night at 8 p.m. was a terrible time to take down the VPN concentrator to patch it? Yep.
Got it. So, I'm the guy who sent the note that's like, hey, by the way, VPN's not going to work from these times. And then now on the backside of that, your boss is like, why did we get 700 IT tickets that they couldn't connect?
Yep, exactly.
That's fun. Just to orient folks as well, generally these vulnerabilities are collected and organized by an organization called MITRE, and they're called CVEs, right? Common Vulnerabilities and Exposures. So one of the things that, Jerry, that you've dug into from like as long as I've known you was kind of tracking CVEs, which ones are important, which ones are not, how complete are they, like kind of holding the whole process kind of to account. So a lot of the stuff that you've built on RogoLabs serves that purpose. So could you walk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah, I actually just spoke at a CNA conference this morning about
CNA
quality.
CNA is a CVE numbering authority.
CVE numbering authority. They had their fall get together, so I hopped on there and was talking to them about quality and completeness.
Nice.
And about how I build these tools not to point out bad people. I go out of my way to make the language neutral, to just show what's being filled in on which record, because somebody needs to measure that, because we can't fix what we don't measure.
Yep.
There's one of the things that I'm proud of with the launch of CNA Scorecard is the use of the patch reference, right? When I started, patch references were down to 1% of companies who would say, okay, here's where you go and download the patch for this vulnerability. They were just expecting people to find it another way, weren't using the schema the way it was. We have that up to about 6% today. It is climbing. Some big CNAs are starting to use that. And some of them said, I didn't know that was in the schema. And I'm like, yeah, it's the CVE schema is pretty large, and not everybody needs to use every array, but we need to know what arrays are there and what arrays people are interested in.
Awesome. So CNA Scorecard is kind of the newest, or I guess the most recent project.
It's the biggest project. I launched it at DEF CON this year. What it does is it shows what software producers are giving what data, so that you can then go and ask them for better data. People really need to start treating CVEs like software that they pay for, part of their subscription product. Like if you're in sales and you know somebody doesn't like your support portal, they tell you at renewal time like your support portal's bad. I'm trying to get the message out that people need to treat CVEs as part of the product that they bought. So if you're I'll use Cisco since they're my employer during the daytime. Since if you're a Cisco customer and our CVE records don't meet your needs, when you're talking to your salesperson about renewal and you say, hey, yeah, I needed this feature in and I need this. And oh yeah, by the way, our security team doesn't get the information they need out of your CVE records. The that's how you're going to get companies to invest in CVE data and vulnerability data in general, is to have it pushed up and have it not just be something that companies think they have to do, that's an add-on to their pre-cert, but that this is how our customers learn about vulnerabilities in our products and patch them. And if you use software from a company and it's their CVEs don't meet your requirements, you need to be part of that feedback loop in there, because I can do so much, but I can't, I'm not bringing a check to the table.
Yeah.
And everybody knows in software, if you bring a check to the table, you can get stuff.
Yeah.
You can get stuff done.
Mm-hmm. Now that makes sense. And like, just by way of history for the audience, right? CVEs generally have come through MITRE, and it's almost, you know, it's a generally a pretty, I guess, resource-strapped organization, and there's a lot of fields and information that should be filled out when you're submitting a vulnerability, because this is how the community takes action and has a record of what's bad, why it's bad, and how to fix it, where the patch come from, all that fun stuff. So because they were getting such a high volume of this from specific software vendors, they kind of delegated out the ability to create new vulnerabilities to these vendors. So Microsoft is a CNA. So when they identify or gets told about vulnerabilities, they can actually submit and create the entry in MITRE. Adobe, right, is a huge one. And do you know how many CNAs there are now?
Just over 500.
Wow. Okay. So that's 500 software vendors who are authorized functionally to submit their own vulnerabilities. The problem with that is a lot of these entries, I've seen Jerry's previous research on some of this stuff, they're reserved like a year in advance and have no information, right? Or we'll see stuff that there's a CVE reserved and there'll be exploitation evidence and we'll have no idea what it is other than the CVE number. So it sounds like CNA scorecard is a good way to show which CNAs are like really filling out the details and making their vulnerabilities actionable faster, right? Is that?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And not because people have asked me, why don't I measure and give them grades? Because CNA scorecard is binary. If you put data in there, I just say it has the data in there.
Yeah.
Because while 150 records are not a lot of records, and somebody possibly could spend their day job hand checking all of those for correctness,
yeah,
that's not possible. And every CNA is selling to a different market, right? The largest CNA this year is patchstack.com. Unless you use WordPress, you haven't heard of them. They are a bug bounty platform for WordPress plugins, and
that must be lucrative.
They have 20% of all those vulnerabilities, and their records are formatted in a way that people who care about WordPress can see the data and know what to fix, right? They put in the data that's needed, and some other data fields aren't needed because, you know, a CPE isn't needed, but the CWE is important for those patch stack vulnerabilities. So it's really about figuring out what your customer needs and tailoring the CVE record to them. That's why the CVE schema is so large and has so many different variables in it, because not everybody has the same use case.
And so you're recommending as a company that they fill out the things that their customers need to basically act on this stuff, because they
exactly.
know their customers better than, you know, MITRE does, Jerry does,
yep.
Jerry Scanner does, right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Exactly.
How did CNA scorecard kind of come about? You gave a little bit of the challenge history, but was there like a moment that you were like digging through a record and you're like, wow, this is not useful. Like, we should track this.
So it all started with CVE.ICU, which gives a high overview of all the records together and says, here's what everything looks like. And that was normally fine if you just wanted to get an aggregate view of how individuals are doing, but the CNA program is really pushed. They went from about 200 to over 500 CNAs.
Yep.
And you need to be able to tell what they're producing, when they're producing it, and how often they're producing it. So it was an experiment to take the data and to break it down back down by CNAs and put it in a displayable format for people to look at. It was a You know, it started out as a chat I was having, I think, with Jay Jacobs, and it was great. And it really that really pushed me to form Rogo Labs. I had everything on my GitHub, personal GitHub page. Mm-hmm. Most of the stuff, 95% of the stuff's on my personal time, right? It's something I like to do. But, you know, I know some really smart marketing people, you being one of them. And, you know, we have to brand stuff. So I decided that it was time to move some products that have been around for a while, some projects that could stand on their own, and put it under the Rogo Labs brand and just kind of specialize it there. And that's kind of how Rogo Labs came around, is just wanting to give these projects a place to live that isn't on my personal GitHub account. Yep. Because they're for the whole community. They're not for me. And, you know, and that way I can go back to putting, you know, F1 race statistics on my personal GitHub account, right? Like, yep. Yeah.
Got it. Well, I mean, everything on there is open source as well, correct?
Correct, yeah. I had this talk with Cisco, like, I'm going to do this. I'm going to put all this stuff out. Mm-hmm. It's going to be free. It's going to be open source. The data is there. Data should never be vulnerability. Data should never be commoditized. That's one of the things that I really push hard for. We shouldn't have a poverty gap in vulnerability data. You know, colleges that have 20,000 students, school districts, small companies that employ 10,000 people should be able to get good vulnerability data in the open market for free without having to go and pay some threat intelligent company $100,000 for your feed.
Yeah.
I'm a capitalist. I like making money. I don't think people shouldn't make money, but I think that there should be a level of data available to the general public that just wasn't there and wasn't available for free. So I just took the data and I try to slice it up and give it to people in a way that's understandable and usable, while not stepping on people who do TI, you know, and vulnerability intelligence feet.
Well, I think enrichment and action's kind of a hard part, right?
Yeah.
But then having the data set, ideally, to your point, like establishing these baselines that the community, right, all of us defenders can use to go against all of the, you know, the threats out there. That's huge, right? And yeah. And I think an underappreciated part of this is having schemas and a normalized data set. So at least when folks are talking, you can talk in the same language using the same metrics across the same, you know, semantics, basically.
Yeah, and that I have a talk coming up at Black Hat Europe in December that we're talking about this, right? What does a post-NVD era look like for the CVE program? There's the global CVE database that spun up. There's a Europe, ANISA has stuff coming along. Mm-hmm. There's a CVE foundation. There is a bunch of different people who are all seeming to work together, which is great for decentralization.
Sure.
But as a history nerd, there's a term balkanization, which is different. It just means everybody's fighting against each other. Mm-hmm. And we're really trying to not get to that Balkans in the late 90s kind of balkanization where everybody is everybody's enemy and data becomes a weapon and a source. And you can't, if I want to get data about software from Europe, I got to go to the Europe database. If I want to get software about America, I got to come to the United States database. And, you know, if I want to get software about China, I have to go to the Chinese database. And you got to deal with all the different layers. And it just makes it harder for individual defenders at small to medium companies to be able to stay caught up.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So is NVD, so natural... What is NVD?
National Vulnerability Database. Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So is NVD kind of treated as a universal kind of list of vulnerabilities today? And like,
yeah,
I know that's kind of in question, hence your talk. Can you give us some background on that?
Yeah. NVD had a government contract not renewed 2 years ago. And that kind of started this whole thing where if you ask you know, 95% of people who look at CVE data, where CVEs come from, they would say NVD.gov. And their SEO was the best, their data was the best, and everybody used that. And then they stopped being able to enrich every CVE just because of the growth and because of some budget issues. So they have, you know, basically every CVE from this year hasn't been touched. So they're behind by about 30,000 CVEs this year.
Wow.
So it's moved back to the CVE program trying to take on some of that data. So now people are starting to get their data not from this NVD, but from the CVE. The NVD will always tell you that they're ran by NIST. Their mission
NIST
was to provide...
NIST is the National Institute for Standards and Technologies, right?
Yeah, yeah. The same people who make sure you get a gallon of gas when you pay for a gallon of gas are doing vulnerability data, right? And okay. It just kind of landed there, and their method is to provide vulnerability, enriched vulnerability data to the federal government, not to the general public. They don't have a mission to do that. They've always been very nice to me and very open to me about suggestions and talks, but at the end of the day, that's not what their goal is and their mission. Their mission was to get the data ready for all of the U.S. federal government. So people just use that data, and everybody kind of just went along with it because they were doing a good job and taking care of it. And then that stopped, and then it went back to the CVE program, and those 18 months were scary, right? Like, if you had a program that required CPE data or CVSS score or anything, you were scrambling trying to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to have good data. And we've never really figured that out very well. And then this March, the CVE program that's ran by MITRE had a contract issue that spiraled into a media storm. It was a one-day contract issue. Anybody who deals with contracts know that that's just
nothing.
That happens sometimes, yeah, yeah. Right? Like, yep. CISA says there was never any chance that the funding was going to go away. They just paperwork wasn't going through, etc. So now everybody's up in arms because they realize how fragile the program that everybody wants to use is, right?
So one late contract could stall things out and got people scared.
Yeah, exactly. So now you have ANISA and CVE Foundation and other groups saying, we don't want this. We want to stand up something, right? Mm-hmm. And we're really out of time where we have to figure out how we're going to do this and how everybody's going to work together and make it work interactively so everybody uses the same data set, the same data source, and the same language to keep that kind of common vulnerability number, the CVE, which is really the Rosetta Stone of vulnerabilities, working into the next 25 years, right? So that CVE 2030-001 means the same thing it does for everybody, and we're not back to unique identifiers per vendor.
Yeah. I mean, per vendor, per country, per...
Yeah.
Per random authority that's trying to collect all the data. That's
yeah. And I'm if you want to give your yeah if you want to give your vulnerability a unique identifier that is connected to a CVE for Europe, that's fine. And that's what the European vulnerability database is doing now. They have their own numbering authority, but the base has to be a CVE. So they'll have a CVE, and then it'll have a UVD. European vulnerability definition number that's right under it that kind of links everything together. But as soon as they break and publish the first one that doesn't have a CVE, we're in a bad spot.
And I assume you have some strong thoughts and recommendations for how you'd like to see things that you're going to be talking about at Black Hat Europe in London.
Yep. I'm going to talk about how decentralization is both good and bad, right? Like, yeah. Nobody should have all the eggs in one basket, but everybody should have to work together. And the state of the world right now, getting, you know, five or six different groups from different countries to all work towards the same goal is hard. It's always been hard, but now with just the state of people's governments and thoughts and like who likes who, it's even harder. And you don't want the CVE program to become a political ping pong ball that gets tossed around in the same kind of vein as tariffs and other issues. It needs to stay above that. For a long time, people's ideals were, oh, make it an NGO. And then we saw what happened with NGOs, and they're not untouchable. So it's a really hard situation with not a lot of good answers, but we know what we don't want to see happen. So we're trying to push hard for that.
That's awesome. Just as a quick plug, we'll actually also be at Black Hat Europe, which I believe is kind of December 8th through the 11th in London.
Yep.
Right?
So, yep, at the Excel Center. Yeah.
Yep. Check out Jerry's talk. He's going to go into lots of detail. Jerry has lots and lots of awesome opinions. He's not shy about them, and his talks are always fun. I learn a lot of new every single time. Thanks. So highly, highly recommended. Do you have the date and time yet?
No, that'll come out in a couple of weeks.
Cool.
It'll be on the agenda.
Awesome. I'll try to highlight so folks can stop by. So if you're in London, come say hi, definitely. So jumping back over, I was actually curious too, because I don't know, what does ROGO stand for? What does it mean?
It's just insight. It's investigation. It's a play on a Latin word that I was just looking for a name of what I would like my lab to be called. And yep. Like, I like to investigate. I like to dig in. So yep. it's just a root Latin word.
I wanted to know the backstory, cause I'm like, I can't, like, that's not initials. I'm not sure exactly. So
yeah.
Awesome.
Yep.
Well, it's something I've known from Jerry is a lot of the work that you've done, it comes from you being like, I need to figure something out as, you know, a side quest essentially. Right. In a lot of cases. And then 48 hours later, Jerry comes up and he's like, man, I just built this thing to go solve this problem. Can you walk us through some like CVE.ICU, patchthis.app, and your forecast and kind of explain kind of what started them and like what they do?
Yeah, CVE.ICU was the first one that I built. And if you go to that website today, you'll see it. The main purpose was to answer those four questions that are right on the top of the page when you load it. Like, how many CVEs are there this year? How many CVEs are we publishing a day? What's the growth look like? And what's the total CVE numbers, right? Like, when we were at Kenna, that was a question that our customers would have, and it would be, they would like to know about and interesting data to talk about. So we always wanted to talk about how, you know, we have 130 new CVEs a day. We can't learn about all of them. You have to know which ones you have to action. So it was just a way to kind of view everything in a scope that allows you to see what's going on and to see what's being published today and what the trends look like. And everybody likes it because all the graphs are like good stock market graphs. They're, you know, up and to the right.
Yep.
So it's fun to track the data. Patchthis.app was, like you said, it was a side quest. I have some friends who work in higher education, and they aren't able to buy threat intelligence feed. It's just not in their budgets to draw $20,000 a year on a threat intelligence feed. And I know that majority of vulnerability prioritizations use public data for at least a baseline of their things. They look at stuff like Metasploit, what's on the CISA Kev, you know, what has a high EPSS score, and they use that as their base, and then they add in some secret sauce. So my thought was, I can give everybody the base, right? I can write a simple website that just pulls together the Metasploit data every day and the EPSS data every day, put it into a simple spreadsheet, and then let people use it from there. So I built that for some friends, and it's got... And then I talked about it at DEF CON, and people really like it because it goes back to the democratization of data. All the data on there is open source. All of it comes from GitHub pretty well. So all I built was the collection tool. Anybody else could go and get the data and pick it up and put it together. But I did it in a way that's easily accessible and digestible.
Awesome. Making it very consumable for some of the organizations who need it the most and can afford it the least. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. And then CNA scorecard was just Part of my work on the quality working group and automated working group for the CVE program, there were a lot of questions about who was doing what, who was using which field, and nobody had good answers to that data. And it was exactly like you said. It started out as I had some notebooks that I was running, and you know, I had the data. I'm like, okay, this isn't digestible enough. So, you know, I vibe coded basically up that website, to help put together, to let people see that data in a clear manner.
That's amazing. Well, and I know like the feedback every time you've launched kind of a new tool has been awesome. Like it's a ton of community engagement. It's clear folks find the tools that you've been putting out super, super useful. Have you been getting, what's the reception been like, right? And are you collecting feedback? Like, curious.
I am super open to feedback. That's what I tell everybody. That's the main reason everything is all on open source and hosted on GitHub. Mm-hmm. If you see data and you have a question about it, or you think I'm wrong, open an issue. If you think you can improve it, open a pull request. I'm happy to look through there, right?
Like, nice.
If you have a question about the data, I want to know so I can help, right? Like, I'm trying really hard to not be opinionated. I have personal opinions about CVE data that I try not to put into the Rogo Labs work, because I want the Rogo Labs work to be non-opinionated, data-based driven, so that you can look at it like
objective, I don't tell people quantified data.
Is 130 CVEs a day good or bad or indifferent? I don't know. It's just, it's the number, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you have to then go and make a decision on, is that a good number or bad number, or how do you want to see it, right? Like, just giving people access to the data and then letting them form their own opinions on the data is my goal. And, you know, since I'm not trying to sell it or to scare people into buying something, just, the data is the data.
Like, well, and that transitions nicely, actually, because I wanted to get your take on some kind of, I guess, best practices and overview of just vulnerability management in general. Like, what's the total number of CVEs up to now? Do you know?
298,000 today, but I think that there's going to be a couple of weeks before they publish. So I'm really holding out that we'll be over 300,000 published CVEs by November is the way it's trending. So,
Jesus, I mean, that's a large number. Like, what's your recommendation, especially like I think for some of these smaller organizations to effectively manage 300,000 vulnerabilities in their system?
We talk about it all the time. The hardest problem in security is inventory and knowing what you run. And it really gets back down to that, is knowing what software stack you've run, and then being able to set up an alert to track those CNAs. Hmm. And then even beyond that, being able to go to their pages. Most CNAs have a subscription-based service where you can say, hey, please send me an email every time you put out a security advisory. And they will. Microsoft does that. Symantec does that. Mm-hmm. Cisco does that, right? Like, it's just, you have to go back to the core data, especially in this time that we're in, and say, I need the data from you today directly. And I'll use the CVE almost as a secondary data source, is where you have to kind of be.
Along those lines, too, I know a lot of folks treat even like CVSS and some of the enrichment data kind of differently, I guess. So what are some of the common misconceptions that you encounter regarding kind of vulnerability management or, you know, addressing the problem, some of the data?
Yeah, I think the main problem with vulnerability data is that people don't understand how static it is. The average CVE record hardly ever gets updated. The mean CVE update is 1.5. So most CVE records are published as is and then never touched again. We don't live in a world where that's advisable. Things change. New data comes out, new sources. So you need to have someone who is updating those records for you in an automatic manner. I push the CVE program to move to a more dynamic record format so that, you know, while the publish date is important, it shouldn't be the most important thing. So those data should be alive. CVSS is meant to be a point in time indicator. It's what people can figure out from the data in a CVSS record. People don't realize how hard it is to assign CVSS scores correctly from the data that's in the CVE record. I went to VolmCon last year in North Carolina and I built a little game that just to show how hard of a job the NVD had. I showed people the description. I showed them the description and any other data that was given in a CVE record at publication, and then tried to have them guess what the CVSS scores were. And I wasn't getting much collision on the CVSS scores because people were picking different vectors and they yep. all had their reasons. And it just isn't as easy as it seems.
Yeah.
And it's subjective. The CVSS score is subjective. Those vectors are subjective to some manner. So they're not always going to be the same for everyone. And you need to realize that CVSS knows this. And if you don't think something's right, there are plenty of calculators and white papers on the internet. You can change the network to local and see how it affects you. Yep. If you think that it's not right.
And just as a backing up a little bit, CVSS basically says, how bad do we think this particular vulnerability is, right?
Yep.
But to your point, it's a point in time. A lot of these change. If the CVSS was calculated close to the date the CVE was published, there's probably a whole lot of different factors that came into this since then, right? And that's the challenge of having these kind of static systems.
Yep, exactly. And a lot of people rely on those or are forced to rely on those because they're PCI or they use, you know, their HIPAA, they're bound by their, you know, by their programs, basically, by their payment card industry and stuff, to say you have to patch everything that's 7 and above. So it's super important for these people to know the CVSS vectors and to be able to understand what they need to patch and then be able to push back if something's not right. Yeah. Because a lot of times if you do push back, you know, one email can save you a week's worth of patching. If you say, hey, I think this CVSS is wrong, right?
Like, yeah.
And most organizations and CVE.org and most CNAs are open to taking that feedback.
Actually, speaking of kind of moving into some of the automation side of things, like do you see LLMs, you know, all the new latest AI technologies helping or hurting this process for companies and for software?
There's been a lot of work. Great LLMs have about 90% correctness, right? Like that's the gold standard. 90% correctness in vulnerability data doesn't cut it, right? So there are a lot of cool demos. There are a lot of people like, hey, it can do this, but like if it's just shooting that out and then you still have to go through and hand check everything to find where it messed up, it's not deployable at a large scale yet. I think there's room in vulnerability data for AI, but it's going to be an AI ML method, and it's going to need some time to tune there. So there isn't an easy button. Everybody wants that AI easy button where you just hit a button and it just fills in everything and everything's perfect. And we know that that's not the way LLMs work. And you know, they're getting better. And I and a lot of people are working on this problem in the background.
Yeah. Well, and I guess to wrap up kind of the vulnerability management piece, like, do you have any advice you'd give to any security teams who are really struggling with, let's call it vulnerability fatigue?
Yeah, it's to understand what's most likely to be breached in your network and start there. And you have to deprioritize some things. Everybody talks about prioritization, though we're trying to figure it out. Like, I like to think of deprioritization as figuring out the 80% of stuff that shouldn't keep you up at night and figuring out what the 20% of stuff that should keep you up at night really is, because everything can't be a number one priority. I had a boss that used to say that, right? Like, like, give me your priority list. You can't have two number ones, right? So, and I think that vulnerability management teams have a full list of number one priorities, and it's every piece of software where that they run, because they don't have a good kind of understanding of what's the most likely attack vectors for their network and what they need to do to be safe and what is less likely to be exploited.
Awesome. It seems like some sound advice, and also may help with some of the maybe professional stress of these roles as well. Awesome. Just to start to wrap things up a little bit, do you have any other projects that you're kind of working on coming up that you're planning to publish soon, or anything you could tell us on that front?
We'll see. I mean, there's always data in the background. There's always more data visualizations. I'm working on a little side project to figure out when CNAs publish CVEs, to figure out like what their status is, and to see, you know, the company that you buy your CVEs or your software from published all their CVEs Friday at 5 p.m. You might want to ask them to, you know, Tuesday morning would be a little bit better for us, right? Like, just trying to give people a view on when CVEs come out and why.
That's interesting. They're like, they trying to bury the lead on a Friday? Why are you giving those hackers an advantage, right?
Yeah, I mean, because that's, I don't want to say that's what it does, but like, I don't want to have to be worrying about CVEs over the weekend. And if you could wait till Monday to publish them and there's no loss, like, doing it on a Friday makes things harder for people. And I know there are different cultures and it's a worldwide program and Friday's not the same for everybody everywhere. But yeah, it is it's something that I find interesting, some data that I'm working through right now.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a wrap for this episode of Security.com, the podcast. So big thanks to Jerry. Go check out Rogo Labs and also check out his GitHub, because all this stuff's open source. You can actually go look and see all the details there. Jerry's also, like we mentioned, he's going to be giving a talk about kind of this post-NVD world and what that means for vulnerabilities, and especially kind of codifying the largest database of vulns on the planet. So check that out. He'll be at London December 8th. What days are you actually going to be there? Do you know yet?
8th through the 15th. I'm actually staying for B-Sides London, which is one of my favorite conferences in the world. Yep.
Awesome. So you've got a whole like full business week and almost a half of Jerry. So if you're in London, definitely check it out. We'll be there as well. So thank you, Jerry. Always, always a pleasure. And I look forward to seeing you in London. You can check out more insights and technical deep dives at security.com. And don't forget to subscribe, rate, and share the show with your fellow defenders. Thanks for listening. And remember, stay sharp, stay curious, and stay human.